This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to Mojo, 30 minutes of articles from the eclectic British music magazine Mojo. I'm Jack Anser, and today I'll be reading from the second installment of the May 2024 issue of Mojo. Please be aware some articles may contain some adult language. We resume wrapping up the cover story on Pearl Jam. I was partying a lot then, McCready confesses, out of control with alcohol and drugs. Luckily, those guys hung on to me. But there was a point when Ed was doing pirate radio from his van, self-pollution radio, very distant from us, while we were flying in planes. It was a tumultuous time. I thought it was going to end. It didn't. Side projects helped, among them Gossard's Loose Groove label, launched in 1996, Amon's two fine 90s albums with Three Fish, and McCready's turn with Lane Staley in Mad Season. Vedder released his first solo album, Into the Wild, the soundtrack to a Sean Penn film in 2007. But Pearl Jam had two of their biggest singles, Given to Fly from Yield and 1999's Last Kiss, a 1964 teenage death ballad by J. Frank Wilson and the Cavaliers, covered at a soundcheck and first put out on a fan club disc, after grunge breathed its last. At dozens of times over the last 30 years, all of us have wanted to do things that one or more of us didn't want to do, Amon says. But the thing you figure out is that the more open you are, the more vulnerable you are, the more connected you feel. Then came Russ Killed on June 30th, 2000, as Pearl Jam were finishing the V's song Daughter during a headlining set at the legendary Danish Rock Festival. The crush of fans in the mosh pit and the wet, slippery ground underneath from heavy rain that day turned into tragedy. 9 deaths, all young men in their teens and 20s. Early the next morning, the band issued a statement attempting to express the unspeakable. It was signed, Devastated Pearl Jam. We came together as close as we could, Vedder told me, looking back in 2003. Stone was ready to close up shop, and I thought that if anyone ever lost their lives at one of our shows, that would be it. I would never play again. But a month later, on August 3rd, Pearl Jam took the stage in Virginia Beach, Virginia, beginning, as they had in Fairfax in 1994, with a song that spoke to the moment, a hurt too big to comprehend on a night for starting over. Long Road was recorded by Vedder with the Pakistani singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan for the 1996 film Dead Man Walking, and again on the Merklin Ball EP, a Pearl Jam collaboration with Neil Young. I have wished for so long, Vedder sang that night in the cool bracing air, how I wish for you today. You're right about that song, McCready says, vividly remembering that show and Vedder's powerful voice for the opening hymn. That's what I've always loved about Ed's lyrics. It can be this very dark thing, and he would have some solution to it, an emotional hopefulness in the face of adversity. Instead of saying, this is all fucked up and that's it, he says, how do we stay positive? How do we find the answer? How do we not fade? The guitarist is alluding to Dark Matter's finale, A Quiet Walk Through the Twilight, called The Setting Sun, which ends with Vedder offering a choice, then a wish. We could become one less setting sun, or be the sun at the break of dawn. Let us not fade. The plural could be about family or nation. It certainly fits his band, halfway through its fourth decade and facing forward with the original sound and mission riding shotgun. The older you get, the better you get at living in the present, Vedder affirms. The understanding that you have less time is the biggest number in the quotient. The goal is to keep making music. It's your passion, your special purpose. At this stage in a career in life, you lean on the relationships with the people who are still around, he says. It really hits you when you're in a situation where that person would be there, and you're sad for them that they're not. But it makes you realize that you gotta be healthy, you wanna be around for your kids, you wanna make good records. And, Vedder adds brightly, we might have one or two left. Next article, it wasn't enough to play Kick Out the Jams. You had to live it. Testing the limit of what a rock band could be, the late Wayne Kramer propelled the MC5 through revolt and reverse, and after a dramatic personal redemption, tended their legacy with passion and commitment. Out of a lifetime of hard-learned lessons had come rare wisdom. Love, man, that makes all the difference, he told writer Bob Mayer. When Wayne Kramer slipped away quietly in early February, felled by pancreatic cancer at the age of 75, he'd lived many lives. If you'd asked him, he might tell you he began his journey as an abandoned son. It was what fueled him to become a rebel, a rocker, a revolutionary. He might confess that he'd lost his way, too, been a junkie, a jailbird, a journeyman. And that, ultimately, he evolved into the role of activist, author, torchbearer, and most importantly, a father himself. Kramer was all that, as well as the co-founder, lead guitarist, and catalyst of Detroit rock legends, the MC5. Though he prized the group's legacy and tended to it carefully, Kramer's real triumphs weren't gold records or hit songs, but more human achievements, his survival, his personal reinventions, and the profound effect he had on the lives of the fellow convicts and addicts he strived to help. Wayne always believed in new beginnings, says Danny Fields, the music industry veteran who signed the MC5 to Elektra back in 1968. He believed you could always start over. That if the pieces were fundamentally there, if the integrity was there, you could rearrange the blocks. And he did that so obviously in his own life. From the time I met him, over 60 years, he continued to grow and develop as a musician and a person, says former MC5 manager and mentor John Sinclair. Wayne was just a beautiful cat. Producer and musician Don Was, a friend and collaborator for 45 years, noted that you could learn everything about Kramer just by playing with him. When you jammed with Wayne, he listened, says Was. He was supportive. He was interactive. He was conversational. He could groove like crazy. He was funky. And he could play these solos that wasn't just a guy throwing notes in your face. He was saying something. He was telling a story. It wasn't enough to play Kick Out the Jams. You had to live it. He felt an obligation to stay true to that as well. And he did, right up to the end. Born Wayne Stanley Combis in Detroit in April 1948, Kramer was marked from childhood by the psychic scars of his father, Stanley, who returned from the Second World War suffering severe PTSD and fell into alcoholism. He went through horrible shit and nobody knew anything about how to treat people who had gone through those kinds of experiences, Kramer told me. And he did what humans have always done. He medicated his damaged psyche. His father would eventually abandon the family. Not having a man in the picture left a big hole developmentally for me, said Kramer. What drove me in music, the need to excel and to be in front of people and make them pay attention to me, was to try to fill that hole. Between delinquent adolescent pursuits, fighting and fucking, as he put it, the teenage Kramer picked up the guitar and formed some early bands, including the Bounty Hunters. But he found the ultimate inspiration in a screening of the 1964 concert film TAMI Show, particularly the performance of James Brown and the young Rolling Stones. It was like, here's the roadmap. They're laying it all out for me, said Kramer. This is everything I need to know to reach some level of fulfillment that I hadn't gotten to yet. In 1965, Kramer and his childhood friend and fellow guitarist Fred Smith joined with singer Rob Tyner, eventually adding bassist Michael Davis and drummer Dennis Thompson. The Motor City Five were born. They were a typical Midwest garage outfit with matching hairdos and suits, playing the covers of the day, but would quickly evolve, propelled by the twin influences of mind-expanding drugs and avant jazz. I thought, what's going to make us different, said Kramer. If I played my best Chuck Berry solo as fast as I could play it, as hard as I could play it, turned my amp up all the way, got the most distortion, where could I go from there? And when I heard John Coltrane and Sun Ra and Albert Ayler, I said, oh, that's where you go from there. You leave the key and the beat behind and go into a kinetic, more purely sonic dimension where you're trying to reproduce human emotion in sound. Thinking in terms that broad, I started to see there was actually a political component to what art could be, he continued. We were trying to find out who we were. We started to see a bigger and bigger place for ourselves in the world and how we would fit in. Helping midwife that transition was John Sinclair, a Detroit poet, publisher, jazz critic, and self-described organizer of artists. Sinclair first saw the band perform at the 1966 Michigan State Fair and became an instant fan. I thought they were incredible, recalls Sinclair. At the end of every show, they played an improvisational number called Black to Calm. And I thought, this was the greatest thing I ever heard a rock and roll band do in my life. You'd have to go see them every time because it would always be different. Sinclair eventually signed on as the band's manager. What appealed to me is they wanted to be the greatest, he says. They were so dedicated. I've never seen anybody that dedicated before, and it was very inspirational. We worked on their presentation until they had a show that was unstoppable, and when they peaked, I thought they were better than any band I'd ever seen. Being a great rock and roll band was one thing, but as the 60s wore on, there was more at stake. The Vietnam War was raging. There were riots in Detroit and all across urban America. Political assassinations. Politics was becoming polarized. Revolutionaries versus reactionaries. Sinclair and his wife, Lenny, along with activist Pun Plamondon, had launched the White Panther Party, allying themselves with the Black Panthers. One of the stated goals of their manifesto was total assault on the culture by any means necessary, including rock and roll, dope, and fucking in the street. The MC5 soon fell in as part of Sinclair's contingent, and they all took up residence in a pair of communal houses in the University of Michigan college town of Ann Arbor. The MC5 would find another kindred spirit in Elektra Records publicist Danny Fields. Elektra, a historically upscale folk label, had scored big with the Doors in 1967, and label president Jack Holtzman was suddenly hungry for more rock acts. Fields had been hip to the MC5 and came to Detroit in 1968 to see about signing the group. His first vision of the band was Kramer on stage at Detroit's Grand Ballroom, spinning around in these lime green satin bell bottoms. What a showman, I thought, says Fields. He was a real guitar dancer. He was partnering the instrument, like Fred and Ginger, him and the guitar. When Fields visited the band's Ann Arbor digs, I was in shock, he says. I was raised in the New York Jewish upper middle class, and I walked into a real-life commune. I'd never seen anything like it. The band were sort of like Vikings, but their propaganda and presentation machine was spectacular. In a way, they were art rock, like the Ramones were sort of art rock. Anyone really good is art rock anyway. While Sinclair could be imposing and the other band members standoffish, Fields found Kramer so totally charming, he cut through everything with that smile and that welcomeness and that curiosity. There are certain people you encounter in life that had they not found you, important things would not have happened, and for me, it was Wayne. During his visit, Kramer told Fields, if you like us, you'll really love our baby brother band, which turned out to be the Stooges. Fields signed them to Elektra as well. Fields is still amazed at the generosity of Kramer's recommendation. In every way, he was a classy guy. For the MC5's Elektra debut, Kick Out the Jams, the label decided to capture the group on its home turf at the Grand Ballroom, recording them live over a pair of shows in October of 1968. It would mark the start of a tumultuous year-long run on the label, filled with high drama and collateral damage. They never really had a chance, says Fields of the group's professional fortunes, citing an incident at Fillmore East in the spring of 69, just as the MC5 were starting a tour in support of their album. Members of New York City's hardcore hippie contingent, the Motherfuckers, got into a pitched battle with promoter Bill Graham over some free tickets they'd been promised. In the violent melee that followed, Bill Graham gets hit over the nose with a chain, and he somehow got it in his head that Rob Tyner had assaulted him, says Fields. Rob wouldn't hurt a leaf, much less a fly, but Graham was convinced, and that was it. He gets on the phone, and it doesn't take long before the MC5 are blacklisted in every market in America. We were scrambling to find bowling alleys to play after that. The breaking point came with the furor over the Kick Out the Jams album, which was initially released with the title track's famous Motherfuckers epithet intact. Jack Holtzman convinced me to leave it in, said Sinclair, and then they refused to back us when the trouble that I predicted started with the record industry. Instead of supporting us, they yanked the record from the market and they censored it. It was number 30 with a bullet when they pulled it. It sold 100,000 copies out of the chute, and then it was gone. Significantly, the Detroit-based department store Hudson's was one of the retailers that pulled the record. In response, the MC5 took out an ad in the local alternative paper saying, "Fuck Hudson's," with a prominently displayed Elektra logo. Immediately, Hudson's emptied their entire supply of Judy Collins records, recalls Fields. All the Elektra moneymakers were boycotted by Hudson, and it was a whole fiasco. That was it for Holtzman and Elektra. They fired Fields and parted company with the MC5. Kick Out the Jam stands as one of the great debut albums in rock and roll history, but it was nearly the band's tombstone. It got to a point where the expectations were too deep and too wide at the same time, said Fields. I mean, they were supposed to change the world, but how much can a rock and roll band really do? Despite the controversies surrounding the group, or perhaps because of it, the MC5 were still considered a hot act. They would bounce back from the split with Elektra, quickly signing to Atlantic Records and teaming with a rock critic and future Bruce Springsteen manager John Landau, who would produce their first studio album, 1970's Back in the USA. In general, my input was musical, says Landau today. I was coming from an R&B aspect. I liked tightness, and the MC5 were not tight. They were loose. They were rugged, not analytic about what they were doing, at times undisciplined. But Wayne and Fred were as good a guitar combination as was out there, and the lyrics and Tyner were incredible. With Landau guiding things, Back in the USA would differ markedly from Kick Out the Jams' messy glory, with a selection of short, sharp songs, including high-velocity covers of Little Richard and Chuck Berry, that presaged punk rock. Kramer would later allow that the album was a somewhat reactionary affair. We might have gone too far in responding to our critics, he said. When Lester Bangs said in a Rolling Stone review of Kick Out the Jams, I couldn't tune my guitar, that really ground my balls, and I was determined this next record was going to be rock solid. Content-wise, however, the group had not mellowed. I actually think Back in the USA is more political than Kick Out the Jams, said Kramer. The problem was the album was completely out of sync with what was going on in the world. The hit songs at the time were Bridge Over Troubled Water and Take Me Home Country Roads, and we put out this record that couldn't have been less fashionable. Adding to their struggle, the band found themselves in the middle of a tug of war between producer Landau and manager Sinclair. John has said from time to time that I did a pretty good imitation of the devil, chuckles Landau. I was reasonably political and certainly sympathetic to a lot of ideas that he happened to have, but I also knew that these are five young working-class guys who wanted to be rock stars. John wanted them to be an extension of the White Panther Party. I thought those things were in conflict. In 2024, Sinclair stands his ground. The people in the industry felt that the only chance the band had to make it was to get rid of the political shit and the avant-garde shit, he says. So they fired me, and I hate to say this, but then they went downhill from there, and I went to prison. In 1969, Sinclair was busted selling two joints to an undercover police officer and was sentenced in July to 10 years. His release eventually became a counterculture cause célèbre, with the likes of Abbie Hoffman, John Lennon, and Yoko Ono rallying to his defense. He was eventually freed in 1971. In the end, Back in the USA would not produce any hits. Released in January 1970, it peaked at number 137 on the U.S. album charts. Undeterred, the MC5 would move on to recording their third and final album, High Time, produced by British jazzer Jeffrey Haslam, who'd just come off helming the Velvet Underground's Loaded. Musically, High Time split the difference between the MC5's first two efforts, but it would fare even worse commercially, barely scraping the lower rungs of the Billboard Top 200 when released in 1971. As the professional pressures mounted, the band would slowly break apart, with Davis and Thompson first to leave the group. The MC5 lingered a while longer, with Kramer, Smith, and Tyner fronting a new rhythm section before a final split in 1972. The following year, Kramer briefly tried to revive the band with an all-new lineup before giving up the ghost. By then, he was already deep in the throes of a drug habit, grieving the loss of the band. At the end of the MC5, the life I'd built all those years had collapsed completely, he told me. I lost my way to make a living, I lost my friends, I lost my status in the community, I lost my future. I didn't know how I was going to survive, so it became easier to just get loaded. From here, Kramer's story would unfold like an Elmore Leonard novel. As he ditched the stage for a life of crime in Detroit, he became a fence, a burglar, and eventually got involved in a mafia-backed drug operation. Set up as part of a government sting, he landed in jail on federal drug charges in 1975. In a way, I was destined for prison, said Kramer, who refused to snitch and received a 5-year sentence. I did things according to my own rules my whole life, and at a certain point, you're going to run into a conflict with the world, with society, with the police. And then they got to do something to you. They got to get your attention. Truth is, I had waited all my life to fuck up this badly. While serving time in a federal prison in Lexington, Kentucky, Kramer connected with another inmate, former Charlie Parker sideman trumpeter Red Rodney. The two began playing music for their fellow prisoners in the yard. I could contribute and be somebody again, said Kramer of his return to music in the unlikeliest of places. It was an identity. I didn't have a gangster persona. I was the white boy with a wah-wah. I could really play the guitar, and people appreciated it. Ironically, the biggest news in the music business while Kramer was inside was the explosion of punk rock, a movement built on foundations the MC5 had laid. In the UK, Stiff Records issued a benefit single to aid Kramer, while The Clash would reference him in their song Jail Guitar Doors. I read Billboard in prison and could see the Ramones, who all looked like Fred Smith, and they would mention the MC5 was a big influence, Kramer recalled. I didn't want people I was doing time with to know about that, because they called the music punk, and punk had a different meaning in prison. Punks were the guys that they had washing their socks. Upon his release in 1979, Kramer would team up with former New York Doll and heartbreaker Johnny Thunders in the short-lived and highly combustible Gang War. I thought this is my ticket back into the rock world, because I could see the fans love this kid, said Kramer, who tried and failed to stay straight in Thunders' company. In reality, I knew this will never work. You can't be in business with active addicts. They have other priorities. A more successful collaboration for Kramer came working with his fellow Detroit provocateurs, on their debut album. I was touched that he was willing to come and play on our record, says the group's Don Was, and we learned so much from Wayne about how to put on a show. Mostly, though, the 1980s would be a lost decade for Kramer. He worked as a roofer and carpenter, eventually moving to Key West and Nashville, while continuing to drink and drug. It was the death of MC5 singer Rob Tyner in 1991 from a heart attack at age 46 that delivered the necessary wake-up call. When Rob died, said Kramer, it was like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. In 1992, the surviving MC5 members reunited for a show at Detroit State Theater to pay tribute to Tyner. Just 2 years later, Fred Sonic Smith would also pass at age 46 from heart failure. The loss of his band brothers marked a change in Kramer. I figured if I've got 20 or 30 more years left, I better get to work making music. And he'd do exactly that, recording his first solo album, The Hard Stuff, released by Los Angeles punk label Epitaph in 1995, and two more records, Dangerous Madness and Citizen Wayne, in 1996 and 97. But the late 90s, having connected with his partner and eventual wife, Margaret Soddy, had finally had the stability to get sober. "By then I was more covert," he said. "I was using prescription drugs as opposed to street drugs and wasn't drunk in public, but I bottomed out at 50. Getting clean finally meant really reclaiming some of the dignity I lost on my trip to the gutter and some of the self-respect that I threw away." Although he continued to make solo records and dedicated himself to his sobriety, Kramer's passion, his real mission, remained the MC5. "I assumed the role of curator of the MC5's legacy," he said. "I started the band, and even though I could barely control it, it was my baby." Inevitably, the last few years of Kramer's life saw him return once again to the MC5. In 2018, on the 50th anniversary of Kick Out the Jams, he undertook another major tour celebrating the group, billing it as the MC50, and working with a new core lineup that included vocalist Brad Brooks, drummer Winston Watson, bassist Vicky Randall, and guitarist Steve Salas. The momentum from the tour would lead Kramer to begin work on a new MC5 record during the COVID pandemic, the band's first since High Time. Canadian producer Bob Ezrin, whom Kramer had connected with through Alice Cooper, was tapped to helm the project titled Heavy Lifting, which features contributions from original MC5er Dennis Thompson, as well as Living Color's Vernon Reed, Slash, Tom Morello, and Don Was. From the moment we decided this was an MC5 project, it became a mission for Wayne to fully capture that spirit, says Ezrin, but also to make this big tent and bring in anybody whose values and background were consistent with the MC5. Kramer passed peacefully on February 2nd in a Los Angeles hospital. "The day he died, I never saw the phones light up so much," said Danny Fields. "He had so much life. He was high energy. That was the MC5's mantra, high energy. And Wayne was a high energy presence. That energy was felt when he was alive, and it continues even after he's gone." For Don Was, the news of Kramer's passing meant the loss of a great, influential artist, but something more too. "My first thought about Wayne isn't about music, it's about the kind of friend he was," said Was, who 20 years ago was lost in his own addictions. "He could see that I was not in a very good shape. He took me out and let me know that if I wasn't fooling anybody, and if I needed some help and wanted some help, he was there for me. He set me on the path to recovery. Without Wayne, I wouldn't be here today. I can tell you that definitely. He was a good man with a capital G," says Bob Ezrin. "He had principles by which he lived and committed himself to the welfare of others. I can't think of a better legacy to leave than that." And that's going to do it for this installment of Mojo Magazine. I'm Jack Anzinger, and thanks for listening.